Leaders of a Des Moines area street gang are now in custody. This hour, more about the months-long investigation by federal authorities. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, Barbara Rodriguez with highlights from the legislature. Katie Pikus with a Western Iowa flood update. New headwinds for the Affordable Care Act. A new study from ISU that put techniques for increasing happiness to the test. And Tony Daner with a preview of this year's 8035 Festival. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this last Friday of March in 2019. Coming up later in the hour in our collection of quick conversations to end the week, we'll talk about the leaders of a Des Moines area street gang now in custody after a months-long investigation. That with our new reporter at IPR, Grant Gerlach. Yes, I know a familiar name, but he's with us at IPR now, and that's wonderful. He'll also talk about a new water quality lawsuit in the state. Barbara Rodriguez will have some highlights from the legislature this week, new headwinds for the Affordable Care Act, and this will be nice. At the end of the hour, we'll hear about a study that put techniques for increasing happiness to the test. They tested three different things you can do to increase your happiness to find out which one made you least stressed out, the most happy, I guess. And Tony Daner with a preview of this year's 8035 Festival. All to come this hour. But first, let's start off with Katie Pikus, our IPR Western Iowa reporter. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Ben.
Katie, in Sioux City, we're following the floods there. Flood update, flood recovery. People in Western Iowa community still waiting for waters to recede so they can go back to their homes. The swollen Mississippi River and its tributaries, of course, as we've been reporting for a couple weeks now, causing widespread major flooding this month. Can I ask you about Hornick? A couple weeks ago, Katie, we heard on this program, I talked with Melissa Anderson. She and her husband, Matt, are residents of Hornick, or were. It sounds like that town really got hit underwater, and that's about 30 minutes drive southeast of where you are in Sioux City, right? What's the update?
Yeah, so most of the town's 200 or so people have been back in their homes, you know, by Monday. Many will have been back for 2 weeks, and they're kind of beginning the long process of assessing the damages, getting ready to rebuild their homes. A lot of people's refrigerators have been damaged, so like the Salvation Army has been in town serving meals every day and just being there to provide people with anything they might need, you know, diapers, milk, toys, and clothes and things like that. And the town is getting some aid through FEMA, so people have been filling out paperwork for the city, you know, what appliances they'll have to replace, whether or not they'll need drywall repaired, and if they plan to continue living in their home.
Mm-hmm. Let's swing from the northwest side of the state down to the southwest. Tell us about that area, the Hamburg area, in Fremont County, and so forth.
Ben, southwest Iowa is just in devastation. I mean, it's been historic flooding down there. I heard from someone in the Fremont County Emergency Management who said the water has just been so high that you can only see rooftops in some places. Mm. I heard from a resident who said that they had to evacuate, but they boated back to check on their chickens, and they were all dead.
Mm. What is the word now? It sounds like it's receding, has receded in some parts. Is the worst over? Are we seeing waters receding all over or not?
Specifically at the Missouri River in Nebraska City, I spoke to the National Weather Service about that, and they said that river is dropping very, very slowly. It's still above minor flood stage at this point, and they need, you know, the water to drop below flood stage and for all of the floodwaters to have receded before these communities can see relief.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the disaster declaration there. That went through, right? You mentioned FEMA.
Yeah, so there is federal funding available to individual people in some of the worst affected counties in western Iowa, from Woodbury to Fremont. And so that process has started. About more than half of Iowa's counties have been approved on this sort of presidential disaster declaration for federal aid for the counties.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose as we watch the cleanup here, the waters recede, hopefully quickly, Katie, we'll be looking for the recovery of these towns. But the devastation there, from what we're gathering here outside of the areas, some of these small towns, the real question of whether they're going to survive, I think, huh?
Yeah, and I mean, there's just been so much emotion in, these cities about that. I mean, take Hornick, for example. I was in Hornick a few days ago, and this couple I spoke with named Chuck and Paula Rose, they said that there's just thick mud everywhere, and the damage is so bad that right now they don't know if they'll be able to continue living in their home. So they've already moved into a camper and are staying in the city.
Okay, Katie Pike is following the devastation of western Iowa, of course, Nebraska, there, eastern Nebraska included in that flooding along the Missouri. Katie Pike, thank you very much for your update on the flooding here.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, came back into the spotlight this week, and plenty of Americans whose lives it touches should be paying attention. 23 million people either buy health insurance through the marketplaces set up by the ACA or receive coverage through its expansion of Medicaid. This week, in a significant shift, the Trump administration says the entirety of the ACA should be struck down by the courts. Now, this was a change announced in a two-sentence letter from the Department of Justice to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said that the ruling made in December by a district court judge in Texas should be affirmed. Here's President Trump this week commenting on the change.
So Obamacare has been an absolute disaster. I have asked John Barrasso, Senator, Bill Cassidy, who's a terrific healthcare person, Rick Scott, and others to take a look, form a really great plan. We're winning the lawsuit to terminate Obamacare in Texas. We are winning the Texas lawsuit, and right now we're on the winning side. Hopefully we'll win at the appellate division and go to the Supreme Court to terminate Obamacare. The cost of Obamacare to people is far too much. The deductibility is ridiculous. It averages more than $7,000, meaning it's unusable. So Obamacare has been a disaster. We will take care of pre-existing conditions better than they're taken care of now. And I've already gotten rid of the individual mandate, which was the worst part of Obamacare, where you had to pay for the privilege of not getting bad insurance. So,
President Trump earlier this week. So often when we need someone to untangle health care policy, we turn to Pete Damiano. He's director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, director of the Health Policy Research Program at the UI, and a professor of dentistry and dental clinics at the UI. Pete Damiano, welcome back to our studio.
Hi, Ben.
We need some splaining.
You need some splaining on this.
Okay. Am I right? Up until this week, the administration had pushed to remove the law's protection for people with pre-existing conditions, but had not argued what it's arguing this week.
Correct. When this lawsuit was originally brought after the legislative change that it didn't eliminate the individual mandate or the tax penalty, but they said they were no longer going to enforce it. And so after that change came about in December of 2017, then early in 2018, there were a group of Republican attorneys general and governors who then sued and said that if that tax provision was no longer in it, that the whole law was no longer constitutional. Mm-hmm. At that time, in about June of 2018, the Trump administration actually sided with a group of Democrats, attorneys general, that said that no, it did not have anything to do with the entire law. And the Trump administration's point at that point is that it really only affected consumer protections, of which pre-existing conditions was a component of that. Mm-hmm. So this change this week. Then in December was when the Texas judge, federal judge, ruled that, yes, he did believe it was all unconstitutional. And there were three different premises for that. And the Trump administration this week, apparently at the urging of Chief of Staff Mulvaney, as the Washington Post has reported, that he was the one that sort of changed the president's mind, and they decided to use this as a way to show that they are going to keep their promise and go after the entire Affordable Care Act.
Okay. There's a whole bunch of political dimensions being talked about on our airwaves and other places. That's not our charge here. So let's talk about, what if this ruling is upheld? We have, what did I mention, 23 million people buying insurance or through the marketplaces or get their insurance through the expansion of Medicaid. What about these people? Yeah, many in Iowa.
Right. It throws a huge amount of uncertainty just into the entire healthcare system. And if you think about the two different components of this, we often talk about the health insurance piece, whether it's the private insurance part through the health insurance exchanges and buying the subsidized private insurance, or the Medicaid expansion, as you mentioned, which is really the expansion of the public insurance side. But there's many, many other aspects of the 2,700-page bill that really is millions of pages of implementation that have to do with not only insurance, but delivery system changes. So there's things like what are called accountable care organizations and the ability of the healthcare delivery system to work together in a way that it couldn't before the Affordable Care Act. There's extended preventive coverage in both public and private, including Medicare. So seniors would lose some of the preventive coverage that they had gained through the Affordable Care Act. Young people being able to stay on their parents' policies till 26. There's all kinds of things that would then have to be teased apart if this literally happened.
Okay. So we heard the president there just a moment ago talking about his hopes for the future, getting rid of the ACA completely, setting people about getting a new plan that he says are better. What are the plans of this administration?
Well, we know from the 2017 time period, at least some ideas of what it could look like. And that's that whole repeal and replace discussion that we went to. And famously, John McCain gave his thumbs down, and that never became law. What we know from that is that many millions of people, you could argue the exact number, but the estimates at that time were, as you suggested, around 23 million people who would lose health insurance coverage. But it really never got into all of these other components of it, including the fact that the states would then, their costs would go up significantly because the subsidy that they get from the federal government for the Medicaid expansion right now is 93%. Mm-hmm. So the states are paying 7% of the cost for the people in the expansion, which in Iowa is about 170,000 people. And so those people would either lose their coverage and the state would lose all of that money. So the Medicaid expansion part, not that it's without its challenges and concerns that the federal government will back off further in the future, but is really pretty heavily subsidized. So the states would lose that funding. And then again, just the uncertainty that it would take and how would you untangle all of these things would be a nightmare.
Mm. Well, let's talk about something that happened yesterday that has to do with the Affordable Care Act. This happened, a ruling yesterday in Washington, D.C., that district?
Correct. So yesterday there was a ruling that came out late in the day about a rule that the Trump administration had put in place about what are called association health plans. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the health insurance market in the United States, we have a lot of people that get it through their employer, and then the individual and small business market is really what the ACA was trying to prop up in a way that it wasn't working well. And the individual mandate was designed to get enough people into that risk pool that it could work. Well, this association health plan rule was one of these that were popular in the 70s and 80s and then were found that they didn't work well. So they basically got rid of them because there was fraud and other kinds of things involved. But it would allow people to group together to buy insurance, businesses. And it doesn't sound that bad. But what it does is it teases apart that risk pool of the people who are left to buy this private insurance. And so there's that. There's these temporary health plans. There's a variety of other administrative changes that the Trump administration is trying to employ that has really been undermining that individual insurance market. And that's one of the reasons that we don't have as many people in there. The cost of those plans go up. The demographics, and particularly healthy younger people, aren't there as much because the cost is higher. And then with the individual mandate being eliminated, that's going to undermine that even further.
Mm-hmm. Respond to some of what the president said. Is that how accurate are his claims about the ACA and the way it's been operating?
Well, is the ACA perfect? Absolutely not. Did it allow 23 million people roughly to gain health insurance coverage? Absolutely. Did it improve the quality of a lot of people's health plans from the first? So for the first time, there's this essential health benefits so that you have to have this coverage of, you know, mental health care and a whole list of different things that have to be included in there. You know, absolutely. Has it changed the delivery system side with accountable care organizations and created more competition? Absolutely. Are the costs still too high? Yes. Is the individual insurance market working well? Varies by market, but overall, not really. But the things that they're talking about doing are going to make those things worse rather than better in general from a policy perspective.
And in the few seconds we have left, speak perhaps to those people. You said tens of thousands of Iowans. We have millions, right. Tens of millions of Americans, but tens of thousands of Iowans who are in the meantime dependent on the ACA for some form of health insurance and health care coverage. Speak to those people. There are a lot of moving parts. You've explained it very well in 10 minutes. What should these people be thinking or doing?
Well, I don't know that there's anything to do now other than sort of pay attention to what's going on. Again, I'm not a legal scholar, but many legal scholars, both conservative and progressive, if you will, have been saying that there's the basis for this lawsuit just really isn't there and the injury to the plaintiffs isn't really visible. But, you know, you never know how things then are going to rule out and if it does go up to the Supreme Court and things like that. But until that happens, I wouldn't be too concerned. But those people are the ones that are going to be hurt, the ones that are getting subsidies to buy their insurance who are between 100 and 400% of poverty, or the people who are up to 138% of poverty who are eligible for the Medicaid expansion, those people in particular. And if anything, what we probably need to do is add some money into this so you can potentially have a reinsurance program for the really sick people to make that risk pool better if we want to have a private insurance component and maybe expand the subsidies up beyond 400%, because that's where a lot of people are concerned. The state legislature here put in a bill last year to provide insurance, a non-insurance insurance through Wellmark and Farm Bureau that's really aimed at those farm families over 400% who weren't eligible for a subsidy and who, if you're trying to buy it, it's really expensive.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for the explaining. I'm going to make a prediction, Pete Damiano,
okay,
that our conversation about this will continue.
That's a great prediction. You're a sage.
Pete Damiano, Director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Thanks for coming in, Pete.
You bet. Thanks, Ben.
And to finish off this half hour of our News Buzz edition of River to River, let's go to Barbara Rodriguez of the Des Moines Register, where she's State House and politics reporter. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
We've got about 5-6 minutes to talk about some of the highlights from the legislature this week. We're glad you could join us. Let's start off with the public assistance proposals and the Medicaid work requirement bill. What is it and where is it at now?
Sure. So, you know, there's been a series of bills that have been introduced this session that are aimed at identifying fraud with the state's public assistance programs, which include, you know, the Medicaid work requirements for poor and disabled Iowans and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is known as food stamps. The bills will not be advancing through a key health committee in the House, which effectively kills its chances for the session. And this comes primarily, at least in part, because some state fraud investigators presented to lawmakers this week and showed that there were limited or just a few thousand referral cases when it comes to fraud in Iowa every year. And for just some very quick context, there are, you know, more than 600,000 recipients of Medicaid. And so at least this key House lawmaker said that she wants to study the data more before advancing any sort of public assistance programs.
And fraud bills. It sounds like fraud had been a main argument in favor of this change.
Right. And, you know, there's a senator that feels very strongly about this issue and ultimately feels that, you know, that there is an appetite for this kind of legislation, that any cases of fraud are reasons to kind of try to address this. But there was also a lot of there was price tag with some of these bills, and so that was also a concern for some of the House Republicans in terms of advancing any of this legislation. So the idea right now is that maybe this is going to be tabled for next year, but there's still a push from at least some Republicans in the Senate to continue this conversation. And this includes that Medicaid work requirements bill, which essentially got the most attention. But, you know, just this week, there was a federal judge who struck down some work requirement rules in other states like Arkansas and Kentucky. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether there's enough support there from lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. A step forward on restoring felon voting rights. This is a key priority of the governor, right?
Right. The House overwhelmingly passed this proposal this week to change the state constitution. It's a years-long process, but it would, you know, the goal is to restore voting rights for felons who have completed their sentence. But it's kind of interesting because it had a little bit of heartburn, essentially, behind the scenes in the week sort of leading up to the House vote. That's because many lawmakers have conflicting ideas about what it really means to complete a sentence. You know, does it mean paying off all your court fees? Does it mean, you know, does this apply to individuals who have committed crimes like murder? And so there have been a lot of lawmakers who are wanting to address those questions now because they feel that it's a key part of this whole conversation. But the legislation is moving forward without addressing those points, but with the intent to maybe introduce separate legislation at some point in the future. So it has a hurdle. It still has hurdles, even as it's going to move through the Senate sometime in the next week. So,
Barbara, the governor signed into law a bill this week that requires state universities and community colleges to adopt policies respecting free speech on campus. Tell us about that, because some would say, wait a minute, I thought free speech was already guaranteed on our campuses.
Right. So the bill would essentially require public universities and community colleges to adopt policies that respect free speech on campus. But it's part of this. It was part of this effort by conservative groups that claim their free speech rights have been restricted in recent years on some school campuses. And it's kind of part of a national conversation. And it's extra timely just because even President Donald Trump recently signed an executive order aimed at this topic and basically saying that a school's federal aid would be at risk if they don't have, you know, kind of clear policies on this. And I think it really picked up steam in Iowa after this court case involving a student group at the University of Iowa. And so it had the momentum this session, and Reynolds signed it this week. And there are Democrats who are opposed to the legislation and say that there's language in the bill that would essentially allow a circumstance where a student group could bar certain students from leadership positions based on their identity, which would lead to discrimination. So that's the component where everyone says, it sounds great, but there's concerns with some of the language in the bill. And so, we'll kind of see what happens now that it's been signed into law.
Very, very quickly, Barbara, we're going to talk about this a whole in more length on Monday when I and Katarina Sestarek focus on this. But an overwhelming vote to evolve medical marijuana laws in the state, right? Very quickly, what happened? We don't have time to go into it, but there was a vote in the House, right?
Right. So the House just, again, they passed this. It would essentially, this bill would change how a key chemical is measured in the form of how it can, I guess it's the what makes an individual high based off of the recreational marijuana. So it changes it from a percentage measurement system to a gram limit over 90 days. And so this is a kind of another step forward in an evolving medical marijuana program that has been in place for the last few years.
We got to go, Barbara. Thank you very much, Barbara Rodriguez of the Des Moines Register. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
So glad you're on board in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. When Iowa legalized medical marijuana, that was just a few years ago, but it allowed no manufacturing, was limited to epilepsy patients. Now we have manufacturing happening in the state, manufacturing of oils, tablets, creams. Monday on this program, IPR's Katarina Sestarek and I will talk with lawmakers and advocates about a new bill that's going to perhaps further evolve medical marijuana in the state. Monday on this program, if medical marijuana has been important to you, then why don't you tell us about your experience? Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll talk about it on Monday. Still to come in this hour, you want to stay tuned for this, a new study from Iowa State University that puts techniques for increasing happiness to the test. There were three techniques that you or I can do at any time. We'll find out which one brought the most happiness and reduced stress coming up in just a moment. Let's talk, speaking of happiness, we are filled with happiness at IPR when we see that Grant Gerlach has joined our ranks here at Iowa Public Radio. Of course, you've heard his voice as a part of reporting here before, but now he is with two feet firmly in Iowa Public Radio. Grant, welcome to the program.
You're making me blush, Ben.
That wasn't the point, but we are indeed so happy to have you on our team here at Iowa Public Radio. Let's talk about a few things you've been covering already. This broke yesterday. Federal investigators say the leaders of a Des Moines area street gang are in custody after a months-long investigation. Tell us about it.
Well, this is an investigation that authorities said they've been working on for months and looking specifically into a street gang in Des Moines called C Block. And what they did is they charged 15 people affiliated with that gang with various charges. A lot of them were about illegal weapons sales or distributing drugs in the area. And they're looking to arrest those folks. They've got 13 in custody so far. And that includes three men who they are allege are the leaders of the gang. And they're targeting them for the activities that they're charged with. But they also think that this gang is closely tied to a number of other violent crimes in the area. So they've been focusing on this group for quite a while now. And they're hoping that after taking the leaders of this group into custody, that they'll get some of that activity under control.
Right. And also I see from your reporting, quoting the U.S. attorney there, that this is a local offshoot of a national gang that people would know the name of, the Crips, right?
The Crips. That's right. So it's the local franchise, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a new lawsuit filed midweek here in Iowa by a group called Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement and Food and Water Watch. What's this suit about?
Yeah, so there you've got a state group and you've got a national group, and they're teaming up to sue the state of Iowa over water quality in the Raccoon River. And they had a small rally on the west side of the Capitol on Wednesday to announce it. And basically, they're suing the state and a number of state departments like the DNR and the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. And they're accusing them of not doing enough, not working quickly enough, not showing enough results when it comes to reducing the amount of nitrates and phosphorus in the Raccoon River. And that's been it's a longstanding problem. And people in Des Moines are familiar with the nitrates that have to be removed from their drinking water by the Des Moines Water Works. And that issue goes back a long ways. But they're bringing this suit to try to force the state to take more strict action than they've been taking so far. The action so far has been largely voluntary.
Mm-hmm. And these extra nutrients come from farm fields, but also from CAFOs, these concentrated animal feeding operations?
That's right. One way or another, one of the primary sources is farm runoff. So that could be manure spread on a field as fertilizer or other kinds of fertilizer spread on farm fields. Then it rains or the snow melts, and some of that drains off into the river. And if that happens from enough fields, it builds up to these excessive levels.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there's been an effort to get cover crops. These are crops that they're there primarily to soak up these nutrients before they reach those tributaries, right?
They can bind those nutrients to the soil and do other beneficial things, keep the soil from eroding and washing off the fields. And cover crops are part of the state's nutrient reduction strategy. This is the voluntary efforts that farmers are being encouraged to adopt. But that just hasn't become enough of a widespread, something that's been adopted widespread enough to have a critical mass that really shows up in the numbers.
Right. So I guess the debate here, Grant, is whether voluntary is enough. Some in the ag community say, hey, it is enough. Just give it time to work. Others, those behind this lawsuit, for instance, will say, you have to make it mandatory?
That's right. Ultimately, they want to force the state's hand to make some of these practices mandatory for farmers. I talked to the head of the Iowa Soybean Association, Kirk Leeds, and he agreed that progress has not been as fast as they would like, but they like to stick with those voluntary measures. One complication that he pointed out is that the farm economy isn't doing so well right now. These techniques, while aren't prohibitively expensive in many cases, they do cost some money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a lot of extra money around, it's hard to invest in this when you're trying to keep your head above water, just buying seed and other things.
Right, right. And we're talking about drinking water in this case, in this
right.
lawsuit. But as we kind of get some warmer weather, we're thinking about recreational water. And it's these same nutrients that would cause, what, algae blooms in our ponds and our lakes, right?
Yeah, they can cause that same kind of thing. The nutrients run off into the rivers. They also run into lakes and ponds and things. And that can cause the growth of that algae, which leads to those warnings that people might be familiar with. Don't go in the water. Don't let your pets drink the water. Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Grant, before we go, I've got to perhaps make you blush again. A big welcome from our talk show team. We look forward to having you on this program and following your reporting otherwise here. You've migrated a bit eastward because you come to us from former Harbor's Public Media reporting position for NET News. This is the public radio and TV network in Nebraska, right? That's where your public radio history is.
Yeah, I was in Lincoln, Nebraska. I was there for 11 years in different jobs. Most of that was with Harvest. So people may have heard my stories here on Iowa Public Radio.
We sure did.
But, you know, I'm an Iowa boy myself. I'm from Southwest Iowa. Cumberland is my hometown. People can look it up. And I was listening to Iowa Public Radio in the tractor doing chores from time to time.
No, really? That's a
I
nice
really was.
Picture.
Yeah.
So how young are we going to see, get this picture in our heads of Grant Gerlach in a tractor?
Yeah.
How old are you when you're listening to Iowa Public Radio in a tractor?
I'm like a sophomore in high school driving the John Deere hauling hay bales from one place to another.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to it. You went to Buena Vista University in Storm Lake as well.
Storm Lake, that's right. Yeah.
And so you're an Iowa boy through and through who's come back I'm trying to think of a good till the reporting soil of Iowa.
Sure.
That was bad. Give me a little time. You can do better than that, I'm sure, Grant.
Oh, glad to join you here.
Okay. Grant Gerlach, a reporter for Iowa Public Radio. We're proud to say, Grant, take care, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What if I could recommend something you could do right now that would lift your spirits, that would make you feel better, and it was a technique that was backed by scientific research? Well, I think I can. Iowa State University Professor of Psychology Doug Gentile is with us. He's part of a small team that tested the benefits of three different techniques intended to reduce anxiety and increase happiness, or well-being, whatever you would like to call it. The results of this study were published in the Journal of Happiness Studies. Yes, there is such a thing. Doug Gentile, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ben.
So tell us about this study. You took a look at, what, three techniques. What did you test?
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, various mindfulness practices over the past 10 years here, and one of them is sometimes called loving kindness, where you wish other people well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the back story to this study is I was co-chairing a session at the White House on video games and children's wellness with Chade-Ning Tan of Google, who is the guy who basically got mindfulness practices into the Fortune 500 companies. And he said to me at that meeting that, you know, the single best thing you can do to improve your mood and your sense of social connection is to, as you're walking around, the people you see, just think to yourself, I wish for that person to be happy. I wish for that person to be happy. And me, the empirical scientist, said, I can test that.
And how did you go about it?
So we had students here at Iowa State come into the lab, fill out a bunch of surveys, and then we randomly assigned them to one of four conditions. And in one condition, that's exactly what we did. We asked them to go out into the halls of the building, walk around for 12 minutes. The people they saw just wished them well. The second was looking at kind of how we're connected, that we often feel separate and apart and alone, when nothing could be further from the truth. We share so much on so many levels, not just, you know, biologically, but culturally, motivationally, historically. And so we asked the students in the second condition to go out into the halls and think of how they might be connected to the people they see. Not just that they're both students here at Iowa State, but maybe last week they went to a restaurant and they got their food from the same chef who got it off a truck, who got it from a farmer, you know, whose bales of hay were put on by your other guest there.
Yeah. How many degrees of separation?
Exactly.
Kind of what you're going to, yeah.
That in fact, we're much more connected than we realize. The third condition is just a straight up social psychology condition, that it is said traditionally that one of the ways we maintain our self-esteem and our happiness is that particularly if we're under some type of threat, that we notice that we're better off than other people. So you might be having a bad day, but then you see a homeless person and you say, well, at least, you know, I'm better than that. And you feel better.
Right. And which one of us has not done that at a certain point?
Sure.
We all do that, right?
Yeah. It's a very basic psychological thing called, it's a social comparison process. And we can do it both upward and downward, where we notice we're not as good as that person, or, you know, or that we're better off than that person. And it's just, it's actually a useful learning strategy for children. How do they learn to do things? They watch other people do them. They compare what they do. So it's kind of just built into our brain to do that. I thought, though, that that's kind of a risky strategy because at its core, it's competitive. And so actually going out into the halls and doing that for 12 minutes might, even though theory says it should make you feel better, I wasn't sure it would. Mm. And then the fourth condition was just a true control condition, because we're measuring things like happiness, anxiety, social connection. Well, walking around might make you happier. Exercise can help people.
Okay.
And looking at people might help them feel better, because we are social creatures. So we asked them to walk around, just look at how people are dressed.
Those are your control group.
Okay. Our control group.
And what did you find?
And what we found is that if they walked around and they wished other people well, they were happier, had less anxiety, greater sense of empathy, and a greater sense of social connection than the people who just walked around looking at people's, fashions and colors.
Mm-hmm.
If they did the interconnection one, where they thought about how they might share other connections with the people they saw, that didn't seem to improve their happiness or reduce their anxiety, but it did increase their empathy and their sense of social connection. If, however, they went around thinking about how they might be better off than the people they saw, that had no benefit and was significantly worse than going around wishing people well.
Really?
Hmm. So, in fact, that didn't seem to do what social psych theory often says it should do.
And so this disagrees with some of the research that came before it.
Yeah. Now, that said, this is that type of research, the downward social comparison research, has been done when you're under a particular threat. And we didn't put anyone under threat in this study. So maybe it would work better if we had told them they were all going to fail. Now go walk around and see people who are failing worse than you. But we didn't do that for probably good ethical reasons.
Doug, did you look at whether one of these techniques or this particular techniques works better, depending on what type of person you are?
Yeah, we did. So some of the surveys they filled out before we went, sent them out into the hallways, were to look at various different things about their personalities. And we thought, well, maybe people who are more just naturally mindful, they'd be better at doing these techniques, right? So maybe they'd actually get more benefit out of it. And that's not what we found. We found that although, yes, the more mindful people, got something out of the kindness, contemplation as they walked around, so did the people who aren't nearly as naturally mindful. We also thought maybe people who are more narcissistic would have a harder time with it because they're so used to kind of thinking mostly about themselves. And so asking them to go wish other people well, that might be difficult for them. And that's, again, not what we found. We found that this simple task of walking around looking at the people, noticing them, and saying, I wish for that person to be happy. It worked for everyone.
Hmm. Well, then in the remaining minute or so that we have, Doug, it seems to be, and you can tell us how to do this too, is we've got to develop this as this well-wishing as a habit, right?
Well, I think, and how simple and cheap an intervention this is, right?
I'm sure there's an app for it that you can pay for, right?
I'm sure there is, but it is interesting. You know, everyone is, anxious and stressed, and they're strategizing, trying to find a way out of it. Without realizing that all of your best strategizing is what got you into the mess you're in. And maybe it's time to do something a little different. Here's a simple thing. When you're sitting in your car, notice the people in other cars or people you're driving past. Wish for them to be happy. As you're walking around your office or your day, just do that a couple minutes a day, and that might help to relieve a lot of that stress.
We will go about this. And Doug Gentile, I'm wishing you well.
I am wishing you well, Ben.
I'm wishing you well, Doug Gentile. Iowa State University professor of psychology in our AIM studio, part of a small team that tested the benefits of three different techniques and a control group intended to reduce anxiety and increase happiness or well-being. That study published in the Journal of Happiness Studies. And Doug, there is such a journal.
Yes, there is.
Okay. Doug Gentile of Iowa State University, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Well, this year's 8035 Music Festival in downtown Des Moines is now in its 12th year, and this week the festival organizers unveiled a complete lineup for the July event in Cedar Falls. Tony Daynard joins us, our IPR Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
We are so eager to hear what is headlining the music festival this year, now in its 12th year, as I mentioned, and you're the man to tell us about it.
Well, sure, and yeah, the 8035 is one of our favorite times of year, and the lineup announcement is kind of a close second. You know, we get to obsess over it and talk about it all week, and it's a lot of fun for us. Let's jump right into the headliners. Yeah, Friday night, it's L. King, a very soulful singer-songwriter. Has got some pretty obvious country, rock, and blues influences in her music. She had a top 10 hit with this song, X's and O's. That was off of her first album. We're going to hear something off of her second album right now. This will give you a great idea of what she sounds like. The song is called Baby Outlaw.
I've been running since the day I was born. I'm the definition of a warren. Shed a tear for each soul set free. But that's what happens when you dance with me. Pity the man that stands in my way. I'm a nightmare even in the day. I'll be wise with which words you say. Cause they could be the last breath you take. Go ahead, baby, tell me. Well, I ain't nobody's baby, baby. I'm an outlaw. Call me a criminal, maybe, baby. I'm an outlaw. You know I ain't evil, but I ain't a saint. Can't help it, I was born this way, a baby outlaw. Ooh, baby, I'm an outlaw.
Oh, L. L. King, something,
right.
Awesome voice and some retro filtering going on there, too, that I
big time.
Absolutely loved. Okay, you sold me on that first lead act. What else do you have for 8035 this year?
Yes, Saturday night, the headliner is Portugal the Man, this band from Portland, Oregon. They've been at it for over a decade now. We've been playing songs from their 8 or 9 records now. From the beginning here at Studio One, they had a huge hit a couple of years ago with the song we're just about to hear is from their most recent record. You have probably heard this song somewhere. It's called Feel It Still, Portugal the Man.
To keep my hands on myself. Still, might be over now, but I feel it still. Ooh, I'm a
Tony, you got me swaying back and forth in my chair here. Portugal the Man. We've got time for one more to take us out. One more headliner from 8035 this year?
This artist is playing in the middle of the afternoon on Saturday, and this is a personal favorite near and dear to the hearts of everyone here at Studio One, Liz Phair, one of kind of the founders of the alternative rock sound as we know it today. Last year was the 25th anniversary of the landmark album Exile in Guyville. She's been touring ever since to kind of celebrate this anniversary. And lucky for us, it includes a stop in Iowa. Here is a song from that album from Liz Phair. This is Never Said.
Okay, Tony Daynor, thanks so much for giving us a preview of the 8035 Music Festival, downtown Des Moines in July, now in its 12th year. Tony, thanks so much. IPR Studio One Tracks host.
Thanks, Ben.
And that preview of headliners at this year's 8035 Music Festival in July in downtown Des Moines ends this Newsbus edition of River to River. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop. Help today also from Lulu Dewey, Sean McClain, and John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a super weekend.